Had I given it on Saturday, I couldn't speak at all. On Sunday, I could barely speak. So today, things are a little bit better. There is a microphone. can you not hear it? I can hear it amplified.
Oh, is that being amplified?
Yeah, at least I can hear it because I'm at the center of the source. Yeah. So this talk is based on this paper. I'm very proud because I've actually got pictures in the abstract, if in case you want to go and look at the paper. That was actually very hard to do, at least the way I did it. So this is the plan of the talk. I'll talk about what I mean by formalism locality. And then I'll talk about what I mean by operational descriptions, what probabilities, the objective of this framework. Then I'll talk about what I'm going to call the simple and the advanced tangos. Okay. So this property, formalism locality, it's a sort of locality property that's formalism specific. So you could have the same theory formulated in different ways, and it may or may not be local in this particular sense. Suddenly this particular type of locality has nothing to do with Bell type locality. Theory can be non-local in the Bell sense, and yet still be it can still be formulable in a formalism local fashion. This property is regarded as desirable because of considerations coming from quantum gravity. So let me tell you what the property is. So a formalism for a physical theory is said to have the property of formalism locality if we can do calculations pertaining to any given region of space-time, employing only mathematical objects associated with that region. So here's a region of space-time. Here's some arbitrary region that we're interested in. This is all the space-time. Imagine we want to do a calculation for this particular region. If we have a formalism that has the property of formalism locality, if we can calculate everything physical pertaining to this region that we want, or that the theory is able to. Okay. We're going to work in a kind of circuit framework. So a circuit, something like this, and then we have the property of formalism locality if we can do calculations pertaining to any bit of the circuit. Here's an example of a bit of a circuit, using only mathematical objects that pertain to that same bit of the circuit. If you like, this is a bit like a sort of space-time generalization of taking the reduced density matrix in quantum theory. Now, in quantum theory, if you're interested in a particular time and you have a composite system, if you're only interested in one part of that composite system, you can take the reduced density matrix and use that to do calculations for that part of the system. Something similar here, except that now rather than having a given time, you have an arbitrary region of space-time.
From the global scheme, from the collection of local density operators.
Right.
So in this picture, I wouldn't imagine that the density operator actually is one of those boxes. Should I?
So first of all, I mean, what I just mentioned about density operators is really just an analogy. It's actually, in this case, it turns out you can reconstruct the global, I won't call it the state, but the global mathematical object we're interested in from knowing the global, knowing the local objects in whatever part of the makeup that we grow. But we'll come to that. So that's really just motivation. It's not exactly like the density matrix space.
Is there a property?
So, if you have a formulation that necessarily consists of evolving a state forward in time. So, for example, if I can foliate this circuit into sets of wires that could correspond to equal time, okay, and then I evolve the state forward by going from one foliation to the next time I have a state that evolves forward in time. I can imagine doing that, and you can formulate quantum theory for this type of situation in just such a way. Now, if I want to, imagine I wanted to talk about this particular region, this may not be the most striking example, but then generally what's going to happen is I have to make, well, at the very least, I have to have a rectangular box that includes the region. So I'm referring to something outside the actual region I'm interested in. You know, you can imagine some crazy region that sort of comes back here and does this, and yet in order to use the evolving state kind of picture, at the very least, I need a rectangle that somehow includes that. So the evolving state picture fails the formalism locality test. And that's true even though quantum theory, as we'll see, can be given formulation which is formalism local. Okay. And so the reason I think this is important for quantum gravity is in quantum gravity, we expect that we'll have indefinite causal structure. So we won't have the option of drawing special shapes with respect to which we consider a system. So we won't be able to draw something analogous to a rectangular box, because a rectangular box is defined with respect to some kind of definite causal structure. But if we don't have definite causal structure, we don't know that our box is rectangular. Really, any arbitrary region is going to be equivalent to any other arbitrary region. That's for quantum gravity. This particular framework, I'm considering circuits, so I have these kind of causal connections. So I don't think this framework is quite rich enough for a theory of quantum gravity. But it's still interesting to consider the property of formalism locality in this context. Indeed, causaloid framework that I put together 5 years ago also has the formalism locality property and doesn't require this kind of definite causal structure. This framework is more elegant in some ways and more immediately applicable to quantum theory. So I think it's interesting, even though it doesn't immediately apply, perhaps, to quantum gravity. Any more questions?
Well, I was going to need this for later, but is it genuinely a restriction on this theory that it admits such a formulation?
That's a good question.
Almost any theory.
That's a good question. I suspect any theory would, but I don't have a proof of that. I don't know. The opposite question may be interesting. In the case where you lose your definite causal structure, so you don't have something like these wires or a definite background metric in the general case, then it may be that you have to go to something like this, so you don't have the choice of not formulating it. That's my suspicion. So there's lots of work coming from different directions that's kind of related to this. So I'm going to talk a lot about pictures, and this was strongly motivated by the approach, the categorical approach to quantum theory, by Samson Abramsky and Bob Kircher. They've also called this the quantum picturalism revolution, which I think I added the word revolution, but they called it quantum picturalism. The framework is similar to the sort of convex probabilities framework that I used in this axioms paper, although actually that has a long history. That sort of framework goes back to you know, many of the many early workers in quantum foundations. And then more particularly this sort of thing I'm going to talk about relates to this paper I wrote last Christmas. I put on the archive last Christmas, put it Christmas Day paper, where I consider those kinds of circuits I showed you on the previous diagram. And then I consider different kinds of foliations and how you can formulate a theory with respect to those different sorts of foliations. I'm going to argue in this talk that that's not the best way of doing things. This paper sort of had a particular way of thinking about operationalism, and a lot of the same kind of points are in this paper. The Pavia, Giulio, who's here, and the other Pavia people who were here recently. Probabilistic theories with purification, and there's just last week I think there's another paper in this tradition by Giulio and his collaborators showing that you can get quantum theory from a set of informational axioms. The kind of causal structure here, a lot of the motivation comes from the kind of causal set work of Raphael Sorkin. We have the kind of post set structure in these circuit diagrams, and a similar kind of structure also appears in the work of Fatini, Quantum Causal Histories, and there's some related work by Blute, Ivanhoe, and Pangan. Then a separate sort of tradition is time-symmetric quantum theory by Aharonov and his collaborators. And one can think of this framework as having a similar sort of, maybe even more generalized property of being kind of time-symmetric, that you can think of a region sort of being pre- and post-selected in a more general way even than at least the early papers of Yakir. And then there's another tradition. Robert Urkel has this sort of general boundary quantum field theory, where he does quantum field theory with general boundaries, sort of like what I showed you on the previous diagram. And again, that goes. There's a tradition of topological quantum field theory at Hayek, and Siegel, people who worked on that kind of thing. And I'm sure I've missed a lot of things out here. If you look at the paper, there's a longer list of references. Okay, so operational descriptions. So this is the language used when theorists and experimentalists talk to one another. An experimentalist says, "I did this experiment," and he draws a picture of the experiment, and the theorist understands what the experiment was. Really, it's a kind of abstraction. You know, the experiment. If you go into the laboratory and you look at an experiment, it's kind of a mess. There's wires. You've got all sorts of incidental features that are not regarded as important. You know, such as the color of the coat the experimentalist is wearing. But you abstract away some essential features and draw a schematic diagram. And that becomes your operational description. So I'm going to talk about a particular sort of operational description in the next number of slides. In particular, it's an operational description that has this object at its heart. So I call these operations. So an operation has, I'm going to represent it by a box. It has some input wires coming in, some output wires going out. These are labeled by different letters indicating the type. So A may be an electron, B may be the polarization degree of freedom of a photon, C may be something else. So those are the inputs and outputs. Then in addition, we imagine this box may have some knobs on it that you can set to particular values. So when I indicate a particular operation by a particular letter A, I'm actually specifying a particular setting of those knobs on the box. So the setting is given by A. And then also, you know, you may have lots of lights flashing, meters, and so on. One particular configuration of all those different meters and lights that flash would constitute an outcome. The outcome is given by the letter A. So the letter A is encoding the particular setting and the particular outcome that we're interested in. And we'll say if the outcome is X sub A, then the operation A happened. So maybe a slightly different way of thinking than some people are used to. But this box represents not just a particular apparatus, but also the particular outcome. Particular outcome you're specifying associated with that apparatus. You may have a different outcome, in which case you'd say a different outcome happened. And indeed, obviously, any operation belongs to a natural set of operations associated with the different outcomes of that particular apparatus. Let me just illustrate it in the quantum case. An output may be, you know, that the electron is coming out the top and then will go into some other box. Whereas an outcome is the classical readout on your meters.
So in this diagram, XA is not any one of those five things you've got in there.
No. XA, you can think of it coming out the side. Okay. Yeah. So the setting you can think of as coming in the zone and out. Yeah. Actually, it is. Occasionally, I accidentally call these outputs and these inputs, and it's very confusing. You need to distinguish two different types of input-output structure. One is the physical systems going in and out of your box, and the other is effectively the data that you're going to record, what the setting was and what the the outcome was. Okay.
And if something comes out of the right side of the box, X sub A, maybe there's another possibility, X sub B.
Yeah, and that would
then,
be...
Then you say it's a different box.
It's a different, that's a different letter, yeah.
So you would have put a B in the center
exactly,
of the box.
Exactly, yeah. Actually, what I'm going to do in the... What I actually do then is, if I'm interested in that set of things, I'm going to use this, that sort of notation. And this will indicate, you know, one value of I is one particular outcome, another value is another outcome. So there'll be some times when it's useful to use this kind of notation.
But setting sort of one-to-one correspondence with outcomes then?
For every A, there's a specified setting and a specified outcome. For a given setting, you can have many possible outcomes, but for a particular operation, there's one given outcome.
Perhaps more than one use of an apparatus is one event in the use of an apparatus.
Yeah, I want to avoid use of the word event. I know that, Meryl, I don't like that, the use of the word. But it is kind of event-like. I mean, this idea of something has happened. A different thing could have happened, and then I would have, you know, so when I draw a circuit here, it's actually... description of what happened, you know, particular choice of settings and a particular set of outcomes. It may not have happened. I may have had a different set of outcomes. Okay, so is that point clear? I mean, it's actually not very complicated, but I think it's slightly different to the way that many people think. I mean, in Giulio and his collaborators use the same notions. And then actually, this is operations take one. I want to make it. Sometimes you may want to coarse grain over sets of outcomes. So rather than thinking about a particular outcome, you may be interested in saying, well, a particular set of outcomes constitutes what you know, is what I'm specifying by this operation. So operations take two. We have coarse graining enabled. So now, specified with each operation, I say there's an outcome set. Okay, so this will be a subset of all possible outcomes, and that's in each particular operation. So this particular A has a particular outcome set. Okay. So this case obviously includes the previous case because this could be a single member set. Okay. And now, if the outcome is in the outcome set associated with that operation, then we'll say the operation happened. Okay. Next, we allow ourselves to connect these boxes, these operations, by wires. And so this is a picture representing that. We can also use a symbolic notation. I forgot to say on the previous slide, Here's a symbolic notation for the same thing. We have to label these with integers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the symbolic notation, which we don't have to in the diagrammatic notation. The reason for that is in the symbolic notation, if we want to indicate that we have a wire connecting two boxes, then we use the same label. So here we have B connecting this, and this is B4 over here. Okay. And now we assume a few wiring rules. So at most one wire can be connected to any given input or output. So we can't have this wire also going to another box. We have type. In this notation.
Yes. It doesn't matter whether you wrote B4, A5, or A5, B4.
It is relevant because. I mean, maybe this is not a terribly important point, but it would be important because I want to say the first one is this wire, this input, and the second one is this input. I may have another operation which is quite similar where they ordered, but that's really just an arbitrary mapping between your symbolic notation and your boxes. Yeah. But the numbers are not, so the particular choice of numbers is irrelevant. Yeah, I could relabel this with different integers. This actually corresponds to the sort of diffeomorphism invariance in graphs. You know, the actual numbers. Which is sort of the closest thing you have to a coordinate each wire, don't really matter.
It's carrying the information of A being on the far left, A being in the middle, and then B being on the...
No, the number just tells you that this one is connected to this one. So the only place the numbers matter here
is
that P4, this output here goes to this one here. I could reel it. I mean, it's true. I did. Maybe that was a bad choice. I did label them in sequence. Maybe I shouldn't have done. Okay. Yeah. The numbers are relevant.
What's the significance of having the same A twice under A?
Here, for example.
Yeah,
so, for example, you have a box that takes in an electron and then also takes another electron in. Maybe takes a photon in here. So I can have the same type of system coming in to a given box multiple times. And I don't have to have the same types going out. I can have, you know, I don't even have to have the same number of things going out. In principle, those things can vary.
You're letting the indices carry some extra information about system type. But does it mean when you write A and B that they're definitely not the same type?
Well, if you have A and A, they definitely are the same type.
Right, right.
It may be that A is actually equal to B, but it certainly needn't be the case, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we have type matching. And actually, the type matching is interesting. You know, you sort of accept it as a very natural constraint. You needn't do that. If you're constructing an experiment and you have an output on one box that fires out small rocks, and you have an input on another box that allows in photons, there's nothing to stop you having the output on the firing at the small rocks going into the input for the small photons. The only problem, of course, is that your apparatus may get smashed. And so generally speaking, this kind of type matching is just telling you to use the apparatuses in a particular way. And I think, you know, that's an important point. I mean, what's wrong? Physics should ultimately tell you, you know, what happens regardless of how you put the boxes together. You know, you could just pile them all in a box in the corner. You know, all your different apparatus would be part of the box in the corner of the laboratory. And physics should tell you what happens. However, this kind of operational description is only going to tell you what happens if you put them together in accordance with these rules. And in some sense, that's the penalty. That's the price you pay for operationalism. Oh, and the third wiring rule is that we have no closed loops. So what that means is, you know, I can go, there's basically an arrow on these wires because the output is always at the top of the box and the input is always at the bottom. So I could put an arrow here. And if I go through a circuit, always following forward along the arrow, I mustn't be able to get back to where I started. That's reasonable because these boxes correspond to a single use of an apparatus. And so that's basically saying there are no closed time curves. Actually, that constraint isn't so essential for this framework I'm going to set up. It is essential if you want to foliate. That condition makes it possible to foliate in a global fashion. So now I want to, another concept. I'm going to find something I call fragments. So a fragment is basically part of a circuit. You know, I have some bunch of operations here, and there are wires between some, but there are also wires left open. So here's an open input, here's some open outputs, here's an open input. Actually, I could have had open inputs down here as well. So it's a bunch of operations that are wired together, but I have in principle I could have some open inputs and outputs. So a fragment has a setting that's basically the setting associated. So for each box I have a setting, and if I specify all those together, I'm specifying the setting for the fragment. It has an outcome set. Well, each box has an outcome set. If I take the tensor product of all those outcome sets, I get the outcome set for the fragment. And it also has a wiring, W. The wiring is, you know, telling you, you know, basically the information that's given in this diagram where the wires are connected. And sometimes it'll be useful to use the notation S and W to indicate both the settings and the wiring at the same time, because those are two things that you are given when you specify a fragment.
So the settings for all the boxes and the outcomes for all the boxes together.
Yeah.
So the outcome of each box is independent of the whole thing? I mean, for instance, if you connect a D or not connect a D, the outcome set of the box C is...
Yeah, so I assume that the operations are defined and have the same properties irrespective of the wiring that they're contained in, yeah. Which is a good point. you could imagine a sort of situation where, you know, depending on how you connect things up, what's actually possible locally changes. Yeah. So I assume that's not the case. Yeah. Any more questions?
Yeah, what do you mean by calling the joint outcomes set the tensor product of the individual?
In each box, I have a set of outcomes for each operation. So a, you know, O of A here, O of B here.
Oh, I see. Cartesian product.
Yeah. So the outcomes, the outcome set of the whole thing is the Cartesian product, the whole thing. One other thing, notice here that I have the same box twice, same wiring. That just means I can use the same kind of apparatus twice. Okay. That's perfectly okay. Okay. Now, a circuit is a special case of a fragment where there are no open inputs or outputs left over. I'm giving you the notation here as well. You can see in this case, if you look at the symbolic notation, every superscript has a pairing subscript because every wire, there's no open wires left over. Circuits are special cases of fragments, although, interestingly, if you break a circuit up into pieces, then it's kind of comprised of fragments. So circuits can be regarded as being comprised of fragments, if you like. Okay. So that's the end of the section on the operational description. So now I'm going to talk about probabilities. Up until now, I haven't really said any. All I've talked about is how you describe experiments. Now I'm going to talk about adding probabilities. You know, that's kind of essential if you want to start to put a theory, a probabilistic theory, on this structure. So some notation. I'm going to write probability of A given B as shorthand for this statement. So this is where I have a circuit which has some wiring, where A, B has some particular wiring. And, you know, I'm actually dropping all the subscripts and superscripts. I kind of have to do that because I'm talking about general definition. I could put back in the subscripts and superscripts if I had a particular example to show you. So this is shorthand for the probability that the outcome is in the outcome set associated with A, and that the wiring is the wiring associated with the circuit AB, and that the outcome is in the outcome set associated with B. Okay. Just simple notation. Here's my first assumption. We assume that the probability for any circuit, something that has no open inputs, outputs, is well conditioned. This means that it's determined by the operations and the wiring of the circuit alone, and is independent of settings and outcomes elsewhere. So if I give you a circuit fully specified with, you know, outcome sets and the wires and so on, then there is a probability associated with that. And that probability does not depend on something you might do elsewhere. Okay. It's a very natural assumption. It need not be true. So here's an example of when it's not true. Imagine in your set of operations, you have an operation which has two inputs. But really, the correct description is should be that it has three inputs. But you didn't realize that. So now it's possible for somebody who knows that to take advantage and send a system into that third input or not, and that will affect the probability. But from your point of view, because you've only specified it as having two inputs here, you won't be taking account of any possible third system, and so this property won't hold. Okay, so it is a real assumption, carries some weight. If you have this assumption, then you can prove, it's just a few lines of algebra, that the probability AB is equal to the probability of A times the probability of B. So, this is where you have a circuit which consists of two disjoint circuits. So this picture here, the whole thing represents a circuit. You know, this is a set of operations with no open inputs and outputs. So it's possible for circuits to have disjoint parts. In a case where you have such a circuit, then the probability is factorized. And that follows from assumption one. Simple to prove. This factorization property is kind of essential, really, to build up this operational framework. So Giulio and his collaborators take it as a starting assumption. Okay, next, the P function. So I'm going to define a function, P, to be this function. So basically, what I have here is a linear sum of circuits with real numbers, alpha, beta, etc. I'm going to define the function P acting on this sum of circuits to be equal to the coefficients times the probability associated with the given circuit, and then sum that over. Okay.
Yeah. So do you assume that different circuits are linearly independent on the left-hand side, for example? You have some vector space of circuits?
No. This is the circuit. So this is what's slightly odd about this is these are just circuits. So this is an odd thing. I want to draw your attention to how odd this is. This A represents a thing in a laboratory, or a particular sequence of operations in a laboratory. We can wire it together in a particular way. And this alpha is a number. It's very odd to take a thing in a laboratory and put a number in front of it and then add it to another thing in a laboratory with another number in front of it. This is an odd thing to do.
Unless the number is an integer.
Why?
Like a two detector.
Oh, but this doesn't mean that, because if I had two detectors, that would actually be AA. Two circuits. If I had the circuit A twice, that would be A times A.
AA is not A plus A?
No.
What does it mean to take A plus A?
Well, this is basically where the meaning is coming from. This function, which I'm free to define because here it is where the meaning is going to come from. So it will end up being related to linear independence, but at this stage we're at a much more primitive point than that.
So actually, the plus on the left-hand side really is not defined. You could put just a comma there.
Sure. You could, yeah. But then, since it's going to end up being related to linear independence, it's nice to have a plus there because it fits in with the usual ideas in vector spaces. But at this stage, it's just it's a crazy string of characters with a definition on the other side. Okay. Yeah, and these numbers can be negative, so they're not even probabilities. Necessarily.
Why do they have to be real?
You could do that for imaginary as well. But since I'm interesting cases are going to be where these numbers sort of are probabilities or are sort of derived from probabilities. So the real is sufficient for my purposes. You may want to consider a more general case. Okay, so now we're going to say that one expression, an expression incidentally, is this kind of thing that appears inside here, this kind of crazy thing. So we're going to say that one expression is equivalent to another expression. I'll give an example of this in a moment. One expression is equivalent to another expression if the P function acting on that one expression, an expression is actually a slightly more general thing than what was in the previous slide. An expression is a real number times a fragment plus another real number times another fragment, etc. Okay. So rather than just circuits, expressions can be linear sums of fragments. Yeah.
I guess with the same inputs and outputs.
It doesn't have to be the case that they have the same input-output structure. However, you're never going to have anything equivalent to anything else given the definition if they don't. So one expression is equivalent to another if we have this property. So here, don't forget, I've suppressed all the subscripts and superscripts. But since this is a linear sum of fragments, and then E is another fragment, and then consider just one particular fragment in that sum, it's important that E with that fragment is a circuit.
I'm confused. Should there be a plus sign between expression 1 and E? Because it looks like
No. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come back to this slide. Afterwards. So here's an example. Here's two things that may be equivalent. They are equivalent if this property is true. So if you look at this, here what I have is this here and this together form a circuit, because I've got the wire A1. And likewise, so do this. So this is now a linear sum of circuits, and therefore I'm allowed to take the P function, because the P function is only defined for circuits, or linear sums of circuits. And then here's a similar sort of thing. So if this is true, then this is equivalent to that. That's an example.
It's kind of like a division in some sense, right?
Like what, sorry?
Well,
division.
If you had a circuit and you wanted to divide out something,
yeah,
you could get an equivalence class.
Like, yeah, this. Yeah. I think I thought about this analogy for a while, and it may, yeah, yeah. I didn't explore it very far. So I think that's probably a good analogy. Yeah, but don't forget, these are, at this stage, these are actual things in a laboratory. We are getting to a basis. So let me just go back. So here's the definition in general. Okay. So what's important is that whatever, this has to be true for any fragment which makes the contents of the argument on both sides into a linear sum of circuits. So that could never be true, actually, if each term didn't have the same causal structure, as you mentioned. Here's another example of equivalence. This is a nice one. Imagine a circuit. A circuit is equivalent to the probability for that circuit. So here, let me just give you the proof. Consider P of A times E, okay? Well, P of A times E, we know that the probability is factorized. This is a circuit. E is now a circuit because A is a circuit. So the only fragment I can put next to a circuit to make a circuit is another circuit. P of A times E, these factorize, so that's equal to P of A times P of E. But now, because this P function is defined in a linear way, I can absorb this into the argument. So this is true. And then if you look at this, then by definition, A is equivalent to probability of A. So it's a slightly odd thing that something should be equivalent to its, that a physical object should be equivalent to a number that's associated with that object. So one thing that's important is that things that are equivalent, equivalence is a weaker notion in the quality, obviously. You know, if a thing can be equal to a number, if a thing in a laboratory can be equal to a number, then clearly equivalence is not the same notion as equality.
But you also said something like,
I've never considered empty circuits. You may be able to do something useful with those. Yeah.
You don't have to say a number equals.
But I like saying a number equals A.
Like
yeah, yeah, it makes me happy. Yeah.
So you can use this to define functions of circuits, basically, right?
So well, I'll show you how I use it. Let me get to that because it's sort of useful for. Okay. So here's the sort of the two, basically the only two general types of equivalence that you can have. So one is where each expression is a real number time, sorry, each expression is a real number plus a linear combination of circuits. So have a real number here just sitting by itself plus a linear combination of circuits. I need that real number there sitting by itself because of the example I just showed you. Here's another one. And you can see that if you take the P function of two of these kinds of expressions, you may get that they're equivalent. So that's one kind of example. These are all circuits, except you have a real number there. This may be the way to work with the empty circuit idea. Of course, talking about that also, all these circuits here could be vastly different. You know, they could have vastly different numbers of operations in them. There's no reason for them to be the same. The other kind of example is where each expression is a linear combination of fragments. I showed you one example of that case, of that sort. Okay. And then all these fragments have to have the same causal structure for equivalence to be possible. The same inputs and outputs. Okay. Right, Tanga. I was pleased with this because first I'm going to show you a Tanga that just involves sort of two operations, and then I'm going to show you one that involves many. Circuit that involves two operations, and then I'll show you one that involves many operations. So first of all, I need to introduce this idea of fiducial preparations. For the moment, just ignore that black dot. Okay, what I have here is. I should have drawn a box, but I've drawn a triangle because these are special examples of operations, which in fact are preparations. So these operations have no inputs coming in, and they have an output, a single output, a single type of system. Okay. And symbolically, again, ignore this lower subscript here. Symbolically, I can represent it by X with a superscript. Okay.
So it would map the empty set to A.
You can think of it in those terms. Yeah. Like, I actually don't like that. Many people use the idea that you map the trivial system into a non-trivial system. Yeah, I prefer not, because I don't worry about trivial systems. I don't have to do anything to get hold of one. So I prefer to think of it as just a preparation of some system. But yeah, you can use the language. Okay, so I told you to ignore this. Oh, incidentally, notice up until now I've always used, in the mathematics, I've used sans serif for my characters. So here. And all the sans serif refers to things in a laboratory. Now I'm going to introduce some standard MAFS font, this kind of MAFS italic. And the standard MAFS font will refer to mathematical things. Okay. So what I can imagine is I have a set of fiducial preparations for a given system type, which I have some integer, some label, a sub 1, which goes from 1 up to k sub a. Okay. So this is a set of, this here represents a labeled set of preparations. And diagrammatically, I can represent the same thing just by having a little bar at the side with a black dot on it. The significance of the black dot will become clear soon. And then I don't need the numbers because the diagrams will carry all the information about how things are connected up. So I just put an A there to indicate what kind of label this is. Okay. And now this set is a fiducial set. This set is a fiducial set if it's the case that for any preparation for a system of this type, I can write it down that preparation is equivalent to a linear sum over the fiducial preparations. At this stage, this object here, which is in italics, notice, is just a set of numbers, coefficients. Okay.
And I add up all over all the A1s.
Exactly, and I'm summing it over A1. I use repeated index notation here over these mathematical. It's interesting. So repeated index is on the sans serif indicates wires. Repeated index over the italic indicates summation, Einstein convention. Okay. Right. So this should be clear. So this is a fiducial set if it's the case that I can write any preparation in just such a way. And I have a notion of just sufficient. So I don't want to have more preparations in my fiducial set than necessary. So then it becomes like a basis, yes. Yeah. And diagrammatically, I represent this in the following way. I say that this preparation for a system of type A is equivalent to this. So now I've got this wire going up, and I've got a link going across. And I've drawn a white dot here. I have a rule that if you have a black dot, you can only put a white dot next to it. Okay. And this indicates that I'm summing over this index. So this pictorial equation kind of conveys the same information as this symbolic equation. Any questions? Oh, good.
So it's not maybe literally a basis, because it might be, you just say it's a minimal set.
It's a minimal set,
but it
yeah.
It doesn't imply that every expansion like that is unique. I mean, there might be some preparations that could be written in more than one way.
I mean, it will turn out that every expansion is unique. I guess I'm not going to talk about that in this paper, but yeah. I mean, I've given you sufficient definitions to indicate what this means, so let's not worry about, adding additional structures that make it into a basis. I mean, I think it is a basis, but that's not. I don't think we need to worry about that time being. So one of the things that I'm going to define, whenever I have a white dot and a black dot like this, I'm going to allow myself to cancel over them and just have a straight line. Okay. So this indicates that I've summed over this index. Okay. you might ask, well, why bother introducing black and white dots? It turns out they're quite useful.
So the box with the sensor A is just numbers.
Sorry, the italics, the maths font.
Yeah, sorry.
This is just an index, yeah.
And the box, this box there?
Which one?
The box.
This one. Oh, sorry. No, that's here. That comes in here. So, yeah, that's important. Just to get the correspondence correct, here I have an operation. It's a preparation for a system of type A. That's the same as that. Here I have a similar box, but on its side, and that's this thing here, where I have italics.
But what does it represent? It doesn't represent a circuit or anything like
that. It represents for each particular value of this small a, I have a coefficient.
Collection of numbers.
So it's a collection of numbers, yeah. This will end up being, this is an example of the thing I'm going to call a duotensor. It's sort of like a tensor, but has a bit more structure than a tensor.
So A, that thing A with that sans serif coming out.
Yep.
No, further over, to the right.
This one.
No, more over.
Oh, here, right.
No, too far over.
Sans serif, this one, right.
That guy.
Yeah, right.
So that means it's like A spat out an electron.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So what is the meaning of adding up over all the italic A's? Like what, can you give an example?
Well, what this is saying is, if I was to take the P function of this,
yes,
and take the P function of this,
yes,
I'd get the same thing. This is a linear sum of a particular set of preparations, fiducial set. With coefficients.
Sure. So if A were one electron coming out, what would be an example of those?
Oh, these would all have to also be one electron. It's the same type.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the meaning of the sum in that example?
The meaning of the sum is the same sum we talked about earlier when I defined equivalence, when I defined the P function. Remember, I defined the P
just
function.
Just adding up over a whole bunch of,
yeah,
so it's,
of circuits. Right, yeah.
So it doesn't mean anything beyond that.
Yeah.
Stage.
Yeah. So this means if I take the P function of this, I get the same as if I take the P function of this. This is a linear sum of preparations. This is just a single term.
It's a linear sum of preparations, but even though it's summing loads of preparations, just one electron comes.
Yeah, out. One electron. Yeah. I mean, really, you should understand this mathematically rather than physically.
Okay.
Mathematically, this is a linear sum of fiducial preparations. And it's a linear sum for the purposes of using the P function, the test equivalence. Okay.
I'm just confused that if you send this mathematically as a linear sum, you were going to get a bunch of A's, right, coming out. You'd just be summing with different coefficients the triangle.
That's right. But look at this instead. Okay, imagine I have, you know, when a one is, when this is equal to one, this coefficient is equal to 3. When it's equal to 4, so when it's equal to 2, it's equal to half. It's equal to, you know, so I just got a linear sum of fiducial preparations. And it's a slightly compact notation. Yeah.
So
yep.
When you make a physical theory out of it and put quantum mechanics in the picture, then this A in the Wernicke square box will be your just the states, right? Like the density matrix.
Which one? This one?
No, on the right. This the square. Yes.
Yeah.
This
this will basically be the density matrix. It'd actually be a list of probabilities. It'd be it'll be the sort of dual object to a list of probabilities. Basically, it corresponds to the density matrix. Yeah.
Specify a theory, you specify the possible states.
Well, we'll get to that later if I have chance. Yeah. We'll see if I have chance. That's okay. Okay. So now we do the same thing for fiducial effects. So this is all the same story. I've just turned everything upside down. Incidentally, notice an effect, is a measurement with a particular outcome specified. You know, so I may consider a spin measurement and specify that I'm looking at the spin up outcome of that measurement. Yes. So this is all boxes turned upside down. I should have mentioned, so you notice that really in these kinds of examples, physics goes up and down, so systems go in the vertical direction, and mathematics goes left to right.
Exactly.
I have a third direction later, but I'll tell you about that later. Okay. So now we're going to do the simple tango. So here's a circuit. This is a sort of general circuit of the sort where you prepare a system and then you make a measurement, or you have an effect on it. Okay. And don't forget, these boxes have outcomes. So I could be interested in the probability that this circuit happens. Now what I can do is, because of equivalence, I can replace this box by this sum over fiducials. And I can replace this box by this sum over fiducials. I'm allowed to cancel over black and white dots here. So I end up going from this to this. Now, there's a funny object in the middle here. Okay, actually, let me show you here, this object here. Here it is at the bottom of the screen. I'm going to call this object the hopping metric. Actually, I'm going to call the p function on this object the hopping metric and represent it like this, as two black dots joined to each other. So what this object represents is basically a matrix of probabilities for fiducial preparations followed by fiducial effects. Because here I have a label that can run over all the case of A possible labels, and here I have another label that can run over another set of, so I have a square matrix with the probabilities for all these fiducial circuits. Okay, so this object here is defined to be given by the probability over these fiducial circuits. Remember that a circuit is equivalent to its probability, so we can just write the same thing here like this. So now I can put this in here, so I can replace this fiducial circuit in here by the hopping metric, and I get this. I'm going to go back to the black and white dots. So basically, I've gone from this to this to this, and then finally I can cancel over the black and white dots, and I get this. In order to make cancelling of black and white dots consistent, I need to introduce some consistency rules. I define a box like this with a black dot on it as being the box like this with a white dot times the hopping metric. So here I'm summing over a label. I can do the same thing over here. In general, I allow myself to cancel over black and white dots. In order to have consistency, I require that the object that has two white dots is the inverse of the object that has two black dots. I also require that a white dot and a black dot is equal to the identity, and so is this equal to the identity as well. Yeah, so this is very much like a metric that can move indices around. But it's moving them around on this object I call the duotensor, which has four sites rather than just two sites. I'll show you the... Okay. So this is the simple steps of the simple tango. So what that means is, here a circuit is equivalent to a number. This is just a mathematical calculation. And so consequently, the probability of a circuit is given by the corresponding. You can see here what's interesting is, to get the probability of a circuit, you just basically take that circuit and turn it on its side and change all the sans serif into italics in this example. And that actually turns out to work in general. Okay, so I'm going to give you the advanced tango soon, or the complex, well, the advanced Tango. But first of all, I need to introduce my second assumption. So assumption two is that operations are fully decomposable. Here's an operation. I'm going to assume that I can regard this operation as a sum. Let me read this here. It's equivalent to a linear combination of operations, each of which consists of an effect for each input and a preparation for each output. So if you look at this picture, what I've got basically is an effect for each input, a preparation for each output, and I've got a sum of those things. And I'm saying that this should be equivalent to that in general. This is true in quantum theory. It's not true, incidentally, in real Hilbert space quantum theory. And this property implies the property people often talk about, local tomography. And I think it's actually equivalent to local tomography. I'm pretty sure of that. But so, any questions? Because this maybe is a bit, it's not completely clear.
Are you summing over all possibilities in the middle there?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm summing over this. There's some matrix here. It's a list of a whole bunch of coefficients that enable you to sum over all these effects and preparations.
So it's a quote, but you haven't introduced any complex numbers yet.
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
Not in this case. I mean, this is sort of equivalent to, you can do quantum theory for density matrices, and then really you have a real vector space. Okay.
Did you define operation? I forgot.
An operation is something that has a bunch of inputs coming in and a bunch of outputs coming out. Yeah.
So it's not the same as a fragment?
No, a fragment is a more general object, which actually, because you have this property, a fragment will also have a similar property. But it's sufficient to just have this property for operations. So an operation is a special case of a fragment, if you like.
Is it unique?
I mean, it will be. It will be because these are fiducial sets, and they're just sufficient sets. Yeah.
Why can't you view any fragment as an operation?
As a what, sorry?
Why can't you view any fragment as an operation? Extend the bottom lines.
You could, but you may have a situation where you put that fragment together with another fragment. And there's actually, you can go start in your first fragment and trace through the second fragment. So maybe they fit together in such a way that, like two C's fitting together, for example.
Yeah.
And that can't be the case with operations. Fragments have more causal structure than an operation. Okay. So operations basically have same time inputs and same time outputs, whereas fragments have multi-time inputs and multi-time outputs, if you like. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's your point about being able to draw a rectangle around. So in case of an operation, you can draw a proper rectangle.
Yeah,
but I mean, for some fragments, there's a missing piece.
Yeah, so you can consider fragments where you can draw a rectangle around them. They're like some big operations, but there are fragments that aren't like that. Yeah.
I still don't understand. Is it just that the operation doesn't have an internal causal structure?
So what's interesting? This is a mathematical property I'm demanding, not a physical property. I can represent, for example, a unitary transformation in just this way. That may be surprising. But don't forget, these numbers don't have to be real. Sorry, don't have to be positive. These numbers aren't probabilities. If they were probabilities, it would be difficult, perhaps, to get information through this thing reversibly. But these numbers can be negative. So it's just a mathematical thing. It turns out that mathematically...
I see. I didn't understand. Yes, that's the definition of this thing. Even though it's
a series. This is a property I'm requiring that any operation should have.
But then A is a sans serif thing.
This is an operation, yeah.
So doesn't that mean it's a laboratory?
Yeah. So what it means is if I take the P, if I complete this into any circuit, okay. So I put another fragment next to this, complete it into any circuit, take the P function of that.
Right, it's the same as the
and then, exactly, yeah.
I still haven't understood why this A is more special than fragment. Why couldn't you just take a fragment and collect all the output lines and all the input lines?
I mean, you, this, this, so So you don't. So you're saying you don't understand why operations are special cases of fragments?
Yes, why are they not?
Because two fragments, I could have a fragment here and a fragment here, and I could join them together like this. And you can see now, this one fragment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you can't do that with operations. You can only join. You don't. You know, you never put them on top of one another. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this is a very nice property.
You could just declare the fragment to be an operation. And then you just wouldn't allow them to join.
Yeah, but that restricts then what you can do with fragments.
Right.
And if you want to break up circuits into arbitrary fragments and then put those fragments back together to get the same circuit, then you're stuck. So it's better you don't. Yeah. That's why you kind of need a theory, general theory for fragments. Yeah. So this is a very nice locality property. It's just saying it has this nice mathematical locality property. It implies and probably, and I think is equivalent to the the local tomography property. Local tomography, yeah. Local tomography is the property that you can take, that you can do tomography. You can determine the state of a composite system by making local measurements on its components. Okay, and this this implies that, and I think is equivalent to it. Okay. Oh, and here. In these horizontal lines, I cancelled over the black and white dots. Let me put them back in this example. Okay, so the fiducial elements always have black dots on them. And then here I have to have an object which has all white dots in the middle. And so this object with white dots provides the weights in the sum over the fiducial elements. And this is an example of a duotensor. Okay, so what are duotensors? They're just like tensors, except each index is associated with two bases. You have one basis, one fiducial basis for the preparations, and one fiducial basis for the effects. So rather than having just one basis, you have two bases. And that's a freedom you have, which isn't usually exploited. I think what really makes this duotensor framework different is that you're exploiting that freedom to choose a basis for each of those and set up the framework correspondingly. They transform like tensors, except with respect to two bases, and I'll point you to the paper to see how that works in detail. And then in general, a general duotensor will be represented by a box which has some white dots and some black dots, like this. If you look at this, imagine I want to change the colors on here. I want to change this white. I want to change this black dot into a white dot. Then I use the inverse of the Hopping metric to do that. Okay, so I can use this Hopping metric and its inverse to change the colors of the dots on the duotensor. You can also write all this in sort of in symbolic notation, and I have a map to indicate how to do that. But I'll skip past that because I'm short on time. So all white dots gives you the coefficients in the sum of the fiducials, as I just said. If you have all black dots, then this gives you the fiducial probabilities. If I put fiducial preparations into my operation and have fiducial effects on the outside, then this object with all black dots is equal to the probability for that circuit or that set of circuits. Okay, so the advanced tango.
Can I ask you, the fiducials are actually real objects,
physical objects.
Yeah, in the laboratory, yeah.
So you can't necessarily make linear combinations of fiducials.
You can't, in the laboratory, make linear combinations, but you can consider mathematical.
You could imagine such things.
Yeah, and as long as you're interested in taking the P function somewhere, you can consider such things, yeah. Yeah.
There'd be sort of virtual preparations.
I mean,
I don't know what
to do. I mean, you could. So in the particular case where the coefficients are all real numbers that add up to one and they're positive, then you could, then it turns out that's equivalent to a convex combination of them. But I'm not defining them in that way. Yeah. Okay. So the advanced tango. So we start off with a circuit, and now we use assumption two, and we replace each of these operations with the corresponding sum over fiducials. So here, this one just has two effects, being summed over. And this one here has effects and a preparation, and so on. Okay. And okay, I'm just took ages to do that. So this is the same graph as that. I'm just stretching it to make the next step clearer. Okay. Now, before I make the next step, don't remember that this is the Hopping metric. It's this object. So I can replace each of these fiducial circuits. Imagine I've inserted the black and white dots in each of these horizontal links. I didn't do that because it would have taken a really long time. Then what I would get is that this is equivalent to this. Okay, it's just the same thing I did with the simple tango, but where I have more stuff going on. Okay, so I end up with, so I have this, and I can cancel over black and white dots, and I get this. This is a mathematical object. In fact, this is just a number. So if you look at the first and last steps, I have that a circuit is equivalent to a number. I've turned a picture into a calculation. yeah. So everything is turned sideways. And really, of course, I could have had it running up the page if I'd chosen different diagrammatic conventions. But I wanted to distinguish them. So I had the mathematics going from to the side, and the physics going up and down, just as a convention so I can distinguish them.
Have you addressed this and somehow I've missed it? What is the connection between the number on the right-hand side?
Oh, and this is the probability associated with that circuit.
So this is the probability. So we think of what's going on over here as an outcome.
So this has,
the thing on the left-hand side is just an outcome. It's a, I dare say, event in space-time, but it's something of the flavor of I snatched my fingers.
Except that it's a bunch of outcomes, one at each box. And I'm asking, what is the probability that all those outcomes happen?
Okay.
And this is it. That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
So I can turn. You can turn a. A circuit. So you can turn the specification, the description, the operational description of this experiment, a particular set of outcomes in the experiment, into a calculation. That gives you the probability, which is the thing you want to calculate, because you want to know what's the probability this thing happened. Okay. Right, I'm essentially out of time. I'm going to skip through. Oh, yeah, that's just what I said already. Yeah. I should have gone to that.
The right question.
Yeah, good. What's your next question? And that's true in general, not just for this example. I skip this. You can take any circuit and break it up into fragments, and then you can do the corresponding thing for your Dewar tensor calculation. So we can, if you want, you can break up circuits into fragments as you wish. You can do the calculation for each part, and then you can put them back together again. But one problem is you may be interested in probabilities for one fragment by itself. Remember, I started off with this question of trying to formulate formulas and locality. I'm gonna go for this really quick. This will not be clear. But I'll just give you a flavor. So basically, the question is, if I have two fragments that correspond to different outcome sets for the same experiment. Remember, I talked about that earlier. So basically, the same experiment, but in each box, I may have different outcomes. And I want to know what's the ratio of the probabilities for those two fragments. Okay, these aren't circuits. These are fragments. Well, it turns out that probability is well-conditioned. What I mean by well-conditioned is it's independent of other stuff happening. If and only if the corresponding Dewar tensors for these fragments are proportional. Okay. So this means and in the case that they are proportional, then the probability is equal to the constant of proportionality. Okay. So now I have the property I wanted. I can take any fragment, and I can ask the question, is there a well-conditioned probability associated with that fragment? In most cases, the answer will be no. Okay. In most cases, if you take an arbitrary part of the world, it just isn't sufficiently isolated that you can talk meaningfully of probabilities. But that's fine, because that's just what the physical theory is telling you. But if it is, this tells you how to calculate that probability.
ratio is for the same set of inputs or something like that?
Yeah, you have the same wiring, the same settings on each operation, but you have different outcomes.
Right, yeah. But there were some inputs you didn't know about.
I mean, you have the same input types, but you don't know what is preparing them. This is important. So what's interesting, you're taking a fragment by yourself, and you're asking the question independently of what's preparing those inputs.
Yeah.
And likewise, actually, independently of what's post-selecting them.
Yeah.
Is it the case that this ratio of probabilities is independent of all that stuff? Okay. That's pretty much the only question.
I mean, you should use a fixed set. You might have an arbitrary choice, but you should use a fixed set. Once you've chosen it,
the
numerator should be computed from the same set of inputs as the one in the denominator. Or does it have to be?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it has to be, I'm considering this ratio for the same closing circuit, yeah.
But it
could be any circuit. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Yeah, so what you can say really is this is well conditioned if I take this and condition it on some closing fragment and condition this one on the same closing fragment, it's actually independent of what closing fragment that is. Yeah. Okay. And I think that's the best you can expect to do. And I think a theory of quantum gravity, which has to be independent of the causal structure, is going to end up having this structure. It will have the structure that you calculate. You have a two-stage calculation. You first of all calculate to see if the probability is well-conditioned, and then if it is, you do a calculation to see what it's equal to. I think it's going to have to be like that. Okay, so you can put quantum theory in this framework. I'm not going to tell you how to. It's fairly straightforward. An interesting question is, you know, you can foliate this circuit and then do the Dewar tensor calculation. So here's a circuit. I can foliate it. Okay. So this is like a time evolution. And then I can turn that into a Dewar tensor, where effectively I have some incoming state, and then I transform it again, and then I measure it. Okay, you can do that if you want, but you don't need to. One thing you notice is if when you do that, you have to pad the calculation with these identities. Here's one and here's one, corresponding to this and this. And that's because you're forcing a time-evolving picture on the situation. But here you can just drop these identities, and here you have a Dewar tensor calculation, and this Dewar tensor calculation cannot be foliated. But it's a perfectly good calculation if you want to calculate the probability of the circuit. So foliation can be done, but generically it results in unnecessary padding of calculation with identities. So I strongly think that we need to move away from the evolution-based picture of physics, you know, thinking of a state evolving in time being transformed. I think that's the wrong picture, especially if we want to go to quantum gravity. But even I think quantum theory itself is naturally understood. It's best understood without such a picture. So I've shown you how you have these two different sort of worlds, sort of world of physics, operational descriptions, world of mathematics, Dewar tensor calculations, and you have these two assumptions. With these two assumptions, you can get the two worlds to tango. You can have hybrid diagrams which have both mathematics and physics in the same diagram. Quantum theory, classical probability theory fit into this framework. There's an interesting possible principle here. Maybe this principle is a principle you should adopt in general, the physics to mathematics correspondence principle. So here's the idea. For any physical theory, there exists a small number of simple hybrid statements that enable us to translate from the physical description to the corresponding mathematical calculation, such that the mathematical calculation in appropriate notation looks the same as the physical description in appropriate notation. So that could be, you know, you go into a laboratory, take a photograph, or actually maybe you should take a movie because the thing may be changing in time. And then take that movie, put it into your computer, out comes the calculation, tells you what you need to know. I'll stop there. Sorry for going over time.
Some questions during the seminar, I suggest that we conclude here the formal part, and whoever wants to remain for an informal discussion is, of course, very welcome to ask questions now.
Okay, so I have to go this way.
Yes, actually, there are questions.
So please leave if you want to.
I just went to a talk where that happened. The speaker left.